E1, number 18B.
See, one begins to feel that truth has now dominion and exercises dominion in my life, that truth takes over, so to say, as dominating power, perhaps as the healing power. And if you go to love and see the total engagement of power, that total engagement is really what, when it touches the human, we let it happen, that it is really the power of salvation, huh? Because salvation means total freedom, it's totally saved, huh? Yeah, well, all right, let's say it's the power of salvation. What the? Yes, it's an effortless power, but in love it must have, a sense of totality, see? And therefore it's a power that does something to the human. It must do something to the human, you see? It must have an impact on the human. Effortless doesn't really, it's, you can also say it's a universal solvent or something like that. Universal solving power. Saving power, salvation. You just feel, you see, that now everything within us is being made holy or is being saved. I just don't find the right word, but you may feel it. Then, when I begin to see that, then comes that break which I had here with the dotted line to soul, where soul now, in the human, naturally does something to the human, to the false objectification in the human. Namely, it begins now to be the transforming power. Transforming power, yeah. Which includes all sorts of things, you see, all sorts of terms. Without that we really need to write them down. It is really the reforming power, the power of reformation, you see. It takes something which is wrong and puts it straight. Huh? That's what soul does. It's the power of exchanging the objects of sense for the ideas of soul. It's the exchanging power, reforming power, retranslating power, not the translating power, the retranslating power. We had in soul, in the divine, we had the translating power, because it translates principle to idea. But in the humanly, it's the retranslating power which retranslates evil back into good or error back into truth. It sets things right again, so that the identity comes out again. So you have all that very, very interesting place value here, because the whole of religious history, the whole of moral and ethical teaching is all based, so to say, on the reformation, that man is reformed, that man is retranslated, that he exchanges his false values for the right values, that exchange, that translation. It's all about that, you see. Without that, religion really wouldn't have any raison d'être, raison d'être, no reason to be, huh? I think you use also the French term, raison d'être, huh? Yeah. This is really, for every religion, the raison d'être. Because if everybody would be fine and happy and like angels, we wouldn't need any religion. So religion is there for the sinners to reform him. And here you can see very nicely, you see, that to start at the point of reformation and to say to somebody, you know, you are really a real good sinner, a real hard sinner, and you really must now reform. And you better go and repent and reform. What can he do, that poor man? He doesn't really know what to do. He doesn't know to reform into what, and he wouldn't really know where to take the power to reform it, where to take the authority to reform it. He would say, well, I don't have the power to do it. Where should I get the strength to do it, the wisdom to do it? See? But here, when we structure our synonymous terms, then we don't just start out and say, well, soul reforms. So you better use soul to reform, because he says, I don't know what soul is. But if we structure the term soul, the symbol soul, and put that specific characteristics of soul, like reformation, into its true place value, we begin to see that we don't have to start really with reformation, but that we start where? With the authority? Yeah? No, you can't. You have to start with the divine, huh? You never start with the human, huh? Always start with the potentials of the divine, huh? When you start, say, with the potential power of principle, and you go through that whole category of the divinely subjective, and you fill your consciousness with that, and that gives you the backbone, the power, the authority, in the human, the authority to which you can submit, because then you have something to submit to. And you have found your authority, and that authority begins to work within you as a generative power, and it begins to begin the dominating power in our lives. And as it begins to become the dominating power of our lives, it begins to be the salvating power, the saving power of our lives, and so objectively it begins to transform us, begins to exchange false values for right values. Then we have found our master, huh? Christ is the master. We must find our master first before we have the ability to transform. And as this transforming power goes on, transforming step by step what needs to be reformed within us, a purification takes place. In that measure, really, that Christ shows itself as a purifying, I think you say, purifying power. So spirit begins to purify our lives, because through soul more and more is exchanged. The more is exchanged for the good, the more purity we have. So it's a purification power. And when it purifies and purifies and purifies to the nth degree, we really have that power which has corrected everything. We can have here the correcting power. Or the enlightening power. Actually, I think it's quite nice to have there the correcting power. Huh? That if we submit to the divine, it acts as a corrective. You say a corrective? Yes. So, again, having to do with an error and saying, yes, you have to correct the error, you say, what, how? Either you try to do it morally or religiously or metaphysically with arguments and statements, but that has nothing to do with science. That's just simple metaphysics. That's just thought power and thought systems, whereas we should really rely on the one and only power there is, on that divine principle, and let that correct what needs to be corrected. Humanly, when we are face to face an error, we even don't know if it is an error or not. You agree with that, huh? That if we are before what we call in quotation marks error or erroneous situation, this is only our human judgment of it. It may not be at all an erroneous situation. It may be the Christ idea, and usually it is the Christ idea. So to start out by calling something an erroneous situation is anyway wrong, because we have no standard to measure it. If we have a standard to measure it, we start with the divine principle and look out from principle, and then we do not see any erroneous situation. Because up to now we haven't seen an erroneous situation. We have in those both columns only see the divinely subjective objective standpoint, which only sees the true idea. In the next column of the humanly, when we accept it, we have just seen the right going on, namely the authority going on, the generating power going on, the dominating power going on, the power of salvation going on, the power of transforming and reforming going on, the power of purifying going on, the power of correction going on. Actually, we have not been face to face with error yet. Because from truth there is no error. Error is therefore only a truth that is not seen properly. Because there are no two entities in being, truth plus error. If there is a oneness of being, then truth and error must be two statements about the one thing. Truth is a true statement about that one thing, and error is a wrong statement about that one truth. Yes. But if we go further to the last column and ask ourselves, but can we resist the Christ? Therefore, the whole prophetic age is under consideration here, because the prophets came and said to Israel, you are a stiff-necked nation. You don't want to bend your knees. You don't want to come back to the Lord. You want to have your own way. And so the prophet's message was to tell Israel, you can have your own way. But I tell you one thing, that the Christ is bigger than your stiff-necked nation. But in order to make that known to you, you will go through hell. That's the only way you can learn. Therefore, I will lead Israel into captivity. Therefore, I will rob you of the temple and of all what is in the temple. I will take away your priests and high priests. I will take away everything from you. I will devastate your country. I will let Nebuchadnezzar come and be the victor over you. You will be slaves. I will use all those tricks. These are the tricks of the Christ, the tricks of the idea. The German philosopher Hegel had already spoken about the tricks of the idea. Here we get all the tricks of the idea. That the Christ idea is very clever. He uses even error in order to achieve its purpose. And I say it uses even error, it uses that what mortal mind considers error to achieve its purpose. And if we look at this last column, we really see all those methods that the Christ power uses when we resist it. Let's see what kind of experiences we make if we are a stiff-necked nation, if we don't want to give in to the Christ and want to have our own way. Then we come to principle, and if you go through your list of characteristics of principle, I think you would find there here, that principle is imperative. That principle is apodictical. See, which means you can resist it, but it's still imperative. It comes to you, to your stiff neckedness, and says, you can resist it, but I'm bigger. Principle does not let go of its aim. It's imperative. It's apodictical. Can you get that feeling? I hope you get that feeling. Because all that have been stiff-necked have had experienced that feeling very often, you know. You just want to give in. You just don't want to give in, huh? And you think, I can't get around. And then here comes another situation, says, you can't get around. And then you try again to get around, to get out of it. And here again comes a situation or a circumstance that says, you can't get out. It's as if that principle just would come as the authority that says, I'm imperative. I am apodictical. I don't give up until you give up. I don't give in until you give in. Or I never give in. But you have finally to give in. And this comes to that resisting mentality as an impact that is of the nature of being imperative, apodictical. This like Kant's imperative. You know Kant, the philosopher. No, yeah. One of his great points is that apodictical imperative that is just working in human existence. Beg your pardon? Dialectical imperative, yeah. Then you come to life. If you don't want to give in and want to suppress the generating power of life and try to suppress it and suppress it and suppress it, we experience something that is very powerful, namely that life is irrepressible. You just can't pull it down. Huh? You just can't kill it. You just take a little seed under the earth, so small, so weak, and a lot of earth on top of it, and perhaps even stones on top of it, you can't kill it. It has the power to move the earth, it has the power to move the stone, and comes right out. Every attempt to suppress life only shows itself forth in the very opposite way, namely that one feels life is irrepressible. Is irrepressible, is irresistible. Huh? You get the sense that life power, the generating life power, is irrepressible. That's why we feel that once we have touched a right idea, that right idea has generating power, and everything can be instigated against this idea, everything can be called upon to suppress this idea with little effect. An idea is more powerful than every oppression and every suppression. It just has its way. And even if it has to grow around the stone, it will grow around the stone and come to the light. So it's no use to try to fight against an idea. It is irrepressible. Or you come to truth, and that truth power, the power of consciousness, that is in the human a very dominating and healing power, well, if we try to run against the dominion of the Christ, and run against the Christ power, well, you know what happens with us? will not be the victor. It will crush us. The prophet says, and I will grind you to powder. But the Christ will come and just grinds you to powder. It just decapitates error. It is the two, it acts like a two-edged sword. It destroys what needs to be destroyed and only leaves that which is the remnant, the true idea. So it's some sort of crushing power, Can you see how the Christ, the dear Christ, can destroy? That the dear Christ can just crush to powder. We say, oh no, the Christ is so lovely, you know. It just knocks a little bit at your door. If we listen to that voice. But if not, if we don't recognize the idea, and very often we can't recognize a progressive idea, and then we fight it, we resist it, and all what we get back is that we are never the victor over it, but that we are crushed to pieces, ground to powder. So here really that truth is the bulldozer that just comes. Very slowly. The mills of God, don't you have a saying, grow slowly, huh? Grind slowly but securely. Is that the, Exceedingly fine, you say, Really crushed to powder, huh? Not only to rocks. Exceedingly fine, yes. That's what you get here, huh? That proverb is right here. And if we have in love the power of salvation, first the total power of engagement, which just is the pure sense of love, which just says, oh, love is that totality of power which just is totally engaged and comes to the human as that total engagement of salvation, power of salvation. And if we resist it, will we not be saved? Can we escape salvation in this case? No. Therefore, Mrs. Eddy calls it that love enforces the salvation. It's the enforcing power. Isn't it lovely? You see, nobody can escape salvation. We can resist salvation. Most people resist salvation. There are very few people who accept salvation. Very few. You think that everybody is right on the go to accept salvation? No, it's not true. Most people resist it because they can't see the idea which saves. They think salvation must come another way than the way it comes. They think it must come the way they think salvation may come, or should come. And therefore they don't see the true idea, therefore they resist salvation. They can't let it happen in a divine way. And so they resist it. And so they never really get the true sense of being saved. But love is so totally engaged that it says, even if you resist it, I enforce it on you. I'm the bigger power than your resistance. So love enforces what best promotes your growth. Yes, that's the theory of it, therefore the principle of it, but now we come to that dotted line where we get the objective manifestation of it, and objectively we experience in soul the resistance against the Christ as what? Naturally, as the counterfeit of soul, as the counterfeit of that balance of soul, that joy of soul, that satisfaction of soul, we jolly well experienced that Christ's idea as suffering. That Christ's idea here takes the form of real good suffering. If that is not good enough, you can say, hell let loose. Huh? Yes. So, again, we find here an explanation which religion can't find, namely that they say, well, suffering is from God. And we would say, yes, in a way that's true. But it is only, it's really not that God sends suffering, but that God through soul sends his whole identical nature to every situation, and when you resist it, that whole identical nature of God appears as suffering. You get the hell of it. Yeah, I have to stop here.